Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hey there, Diane. What's new?
What's new? Well, we're mid-April, almost a month into spring.
Yes, we are.
And you know what tomorrow is? T-Day. Tax day.
Well, actually, not officially and not till the 17th.
That's true, because it's a Sunday and blah, blah, blah. So I'm hoping there's enough fun in our show to ease the pain. You know, it's going to be a fun show tonight. So listeners, take a break. You know, put your feet up and just chill for an hour. You've been following the progress of Levi Leipheimer?
No, I haven't heard anything. Give me an update on that.
Well, it's very interesting. Thousands of people have been following him on his Twitter feed. I mean, literally tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a very interesting and somewhat revealing article by a writer by the name of Bob Padecki of the Press Democrat in Santa Rosa, California. It seems that Levi had a premonition of being hit about 60 seconds before the accident that would send him flying through the air and destroyed his bike and broke his left fibula. Yes. It's an interesting phenomenon, but one that I try to kind of instill in my yoga students, that if you can trust your intuition, it actually works very well. Some people call it just trusting your gut, but it's the same. Meanwhile, Levi's resting, and he's occasionally spinning, although he's not supposed to be, until he gets that sharp pain going up his leg. He's still wary, he says, and he's very grateful.
Yeah.
So it is yet to be seen whether he will be in the Tour of California next month. So that's the upshot on Levi.
Okay.
You want to talk about tonight's show?
Sure.
Okay. We have two really cool guests. Bill Humphreys was one of the very first riders to go over to Europe back in the early 70s. He pioneered the position of domestique for the Americans and was also a member of the first American-sponsored team in an international road race. He's been a coach, a race promoter, and he's now the author of what competitive cyclists called the Book of the Year, the Jersey Project. Bill will be on his way from his home in Old Lyme, Connecticut, to a book signing with some celebrities after the show. So we will hear what he has to say. Then we have a multi-talented, kind of cool guy. He's very deeply layered. He's another one of these guys who goes way back into the 60s and 70s with cycling, which is very cool. Lives in New York City. His name's John Campo, better known as Campo Cat. He's an accomplished musician, several hit titles. He's a woodworker, the son of a woodworker. He's authored 5 books. He's a bike racer. Oh, yeah. He's also the guy who brought the Casino Velodrome back to reality in New York City. As if he didn't have enough to do, he's also with us talking this evening. So that's pretty much our show.
All right.
You ready?
Let's dive right in.
All right. Bill Humphreys, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, this is pretty exciting because I know all about your project and I know where you're going after our interview this evening. So we'll talk about all that. I'd like to introduce you to our listening audience with a bit about your background. You are one of the first American cyclists to race in Europe.
I was fortunate enough to qualify that. Guys had been there before me for sure. But what was unique about my experience was it was the first sponsored American U.S. team that ever raced a stage race in Europe. And you have to qualify that because there were a lot of guys, pioneers, that went over there on their own before me. And I talk about them in the book.
And that is the book we're going to talk about, The Jersey Project. You raced with one of my really, really good friends, John Howard.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I was John's domestique for 3 years.
Yeah, you sort of coined that position in American cycling, I understand.
Yeah, I made a conscious decision. There were so many stars on the existing Raleigh team and Century Road Club of America team that if I was going to work my way onto that list of riders, that A team, that there was no way I was going to be in a winning mode. I was going to have to be a support rider. So I that was the role I took on.
That's an important role even today, a very important role. It's what really makes the winners win.
It is, and in my day there were a lot of egos, you know, and there still are.
I was just going to say, I didn't think that had changed.
Yeah, but, you know, it took guys a while to get as good as they were because there was no coaching, per se, unless you were part of an old club system, which I was a part of. So older riders tended to be guys that had learned on their own, and they weren't about to give up, you know, all their secrets, and understandably so. And when I came along, I realized instantly that, you know, that was a role that was available, and that if I didn't mind carrying a pump and a spare and working for these guys, which they were quite surprised that they had never really had a true domestique. They were pretty much battled against themselves, even if they were on the same team in those days.
Huh. Interesting. Who were some of the other guys on this Century team?
Well, you know, there was John Howard, who was recruited for the club because they had the Raleigh sponsorship coming. There was John Alice, who was the real institution and been a member of the club the longest.
Right.
And Stan Swaim, another old-timer who had been racing before there were derailers. He was racing back in the late 50s. You know, and then there was guys like Bobby Phillips, who up until, say, the last 15 years was the most winningest rider in America before Davis Finney finally just, you know, overtook that position. And Dave Chawner, you know, another two-time Olympian.
Right.
Who worked for Cop Cyclery. So, and Doug Dale, who was a long-time stalwart in the Northeast and so forth.
Well, it's interesting that these names are now historical, and yet it sort of took your book to bring them back into the fore. You know, it's kind of nice that you've done what you've done with this book. So when you retired from racing, assuming, of course, that you have.
Yes.
What did you do until the book, which is...
Wow, that's a lot of years, it was... I went right into coaching. I was fortunate enough, Butch Martin was the first national team road coach of the modern era, and he was assigned that position in 1974, and he was racing in 73, and he still was very active, and I was on one of his first teams as a rider, and I was a domestique, and I knew my position, and we went to ride the Tour of Newfoundland in 1974, and then in 75, I tapered down and went into grassroots coaching, and he gave me my first assignment, and he said, "Bike guy, you got to be a coach, and I want to send you to the jungle." And they sent new coaches and new up-and-coming riders into Latin America to learn the ropes.
Oh, the serious jungle.
Yeah, that was the term he used. So I got my first assignment to go to Vuelta Costa Rica in the winter of 77 into 78. But the original... question was, I coached and traveled, and I pioneered the position of soigneur for the U.S. cycling team. I moved into the Olympic Training Center with Eddie B. And then in 1980, we weren't going to go to Moscow, and I just came home from 6 weeks in Europe in the fall of in the late fall of 79, and I realized we were going to boycott the Olympics. I wasn't going to wait around four more years to be a coach at the Olympic team. And I moved on into promotion, and I got involved with a fella who is the co-partner in the book, Jerry Dunn. And we promoted races and started in Worcester, Massachusetts, but we relocated to Florida, and I produced about 14 major races in the Tampa Bay area up until about 1989. Then I ended up going back to college and getting my degree in sports marketing and management and worked at Bicycling Magazine. And that was my first time having a job inside the industry with a paycheck and benefits and working for somebody else. And then I went to work for Lightspeed after that as a sales rep. And then after that, my boy was 5 years old and I needed to stay home. And I found jobs locally and promoted a couple races locally and was a consultant and wrote some articles for different magazines. And then slowly the book emerged in the last year and a half.
So before we delve into the book, tell us the story about how you got the term bike guy. Because you are the original bike guy.
That's a great story, and it goes back to 73. I mean, people don't realize that I'm starting to do a blog now.
Oh, good.
Because I have my training diaries from 73, 4, and 5. And what I realized was, you know, the summer before, in the summer of 72, I got disgusted with bike racing in Southern California, where I was just a long-haired hippie and could win a couple novice races. But after that, I was thrown in with, you know, the heavy-duty guys, because there was only three categories of racing. And I was getting blown out the back and couldn't understand the sport. And I rode my bike across the United States. And I rode into Montreal, and then I heard about the longest one-day race in America, which started in Quebec and finished in Montreal. I raced that race, and then the following year, I am on the Raleigh A-team. Huh. And we're back up in Canada for a stage race in June. And I'm on this team, and Jimmy Hutter looks across the table at me, and he was a rock star on the Century team who was at Quebec, Montreal the year before when I was a long-haired hippie and rode up to the starting line with pannier bags on, hairy legs, ponytail. I mean, I had a Bacardi rum sticker on my top tube of my oversized Raleigh Pro. I mean, I was disgusting. And I go up to Jimmy, who is immaculate prima donna, who has just been cut from the alternate long team for the Munich Olympics. And he has his Schwinn with his Munich sticker on it, and he's got his crew. And I don't know him from Adam, and I just walk up to him, and I'm saying, hey, my name is Bill Humphreys. I just rode in from San Diego for the race. Would you mind carrying my Pletcher rack and my panniers to the finish line? I mean, can you imagine?
Hey, that's ballsy. What can I tell you?
he was insulted. He looked at his loopy, his right-hand man, and he says, hey, Dean, he says, can you give this guy a hand and give him a Pletcher rack? And then he took off. Well, the next year, I'm on the Raleigh team for this Tour de l'Est stage race in Canada, and we're all sitting around the table, and I'm with Chawner, Alice, Howie, Swaim, and Hutter, and me, the new guy. Now I have a haircut, right?
Right.
My legs are shaved.
Good
I'm
boy.
On a Chanelli. I got a Raleigh jersey.
Right.
And he looks across the table at me, and he goes, I know this guy from somewhere. I know
right.
this guy from somewhere. And Chawner knows the story a little bit, see? And Chawner looks, yeah, that's the bike guy. He came in from out of the West.
Oh, my goodness. Did he like, do a double take?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hutter goes, wait a minute, you're the guy that asked me for the Pletcher rack.
And exactly.
Ever since then, if I call Jimmy right now, that's for, hey, bike guy,
hey,
you need a Pletcher
guy.
Rack, you need a wrench for your Pletcher rack.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Bill Humphreys, and we're going to now be talking about his amazing book called The Jersey Project. If you haven't seen the book, we'll tell you how to get one at the end of our interview. Now, I saw this Jersey Project or parts of it at Interbike, I think, yes?
That was my official launch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so tell us about how this book came about, what the book is. It's a wonderful story, just how the book even began to unfold for you.
Yes, it is. It's a precious story. And, you know, I made friends back in 78 with a very famous Dutchman named Rini Wakmans. He was written up in Velo News in 78. I'll never forget it because he was a race promoter and a former rider. And he had, that summer, he had brought the Tour de France into his small little town of St. Willebrand, Holland. And that was worth millions of dollars to the local community. And he was the national Dutch cycling coach, and he had coached the 100-kilometer team time trial world's champions that same year. And I wanted to meet him, and all of a sudden, I'm the soigneur at the Tour de l'Avenir, and we met and we became friends. Now, we ended up doing a lot of projects together and business and friends and traveling back and forth, having Dutch riders at my races in Florida. And then finally, I get married. I have this boy, and I'm going, I have to take my boy to the Tour de France, and I have to do it while it starts in Rotterdam because Rini was responsible for bringing it to Rotterdam. Rini's getting older. My boy's 11. This is my sales pitch to my wife. And I say, I've got to take my son to the Tour, and I got to do it now. So I go, and Rini has VIP for us, and my son gets to see, you know, amazing people and gets to look at his dad from a totally different light. And
sure.
When the race is over, Rini meets with me, and he says, listen, I have this book that I want you to see. And he shows me this book that's all in Dutch, and it's 300 pages, and it's gorgeous, beautiful pictures of all the famous racing jerseys, the gods, the legends, everybody I ever looked up to and tried to emulate. All these, and I'm looking through the pages of the book, and there's, you know, it's all in Dutch context and stories. And I'm just getting chills, and I'm just going, oh, my God, this is striking every chord. This is everything I ever wanted to be. And Rini looks at me, and he can tell that I'm taken, and I'm looking at this guy, and this is a hard-nosed Dutchman, you know. And he wrote the introduction to the book, and he says to me, do you want the rights to this? And I said, yes, I would love to have an English translation and add some American jerseys to this. I think it would be phenomenal. And he said, well, okay, you know, I can arrange for that. And I came home with some books and showed them to my business partner who lived down in Savannah and Georgia. And Jerry, who knew Rini and so forth, just called me up and said, this is amazing. You know, of all the years we've been banging around together, trying all these different things, we've come close to big-time things, we've had a lot of success. But this little book, this might be the thing that really turns the corner for me, personally. And it's a great opportunity, and we were humbled by it, because every time we looked through the book, we just said, oh, my God, this is such a piece of historic archival history told through the jerseys. It's such an interesting approach. It's been overlooked, and so from there we began the process. And this was in August of 2010. We began the process of figuring out just how to get the rights from the original Dutch publisher, and then how to proceed. You know, how to get jerseys, how to do this, how to do that, and it took a year, and we got it done.
Well, in the opening of the book, you state something that I found very interesting, and that is that youngsters in Europe wear cycling jerseys much like youngsters here might wear a team shirt for, say, their favorite ball player, like we had LeBron James here for so long. And so suddenly everybody had a LeBron James shirt of some sort. Yet when you received your first cycling jersey, it conjured up a very different image. You know, your Raleigh jersey, that embroidered wool jersey. Tell me what the difference is. I mean, I understand it, but for those who are listening who might wear their favorite team jersey, what that cycling jersey really means.
Well, in the 70s, you know, it was a subculture, and those of us, you know, what I'm comparing there is a Dutch kid gets a cycling jersey from his local club. It's like putting on his Little League jersey. It's part of the culture. It's no big deal. He's thrilled about it. But it's part of what they do. In this country, those of us who stumbled across cycling, we stumbled across it because somebody else brought us into it that knew the history of it. And by the time we got to the point of buying our first jersey, we realized how important a statement we were making in putting on a cycling jersey as opposed to a Little League jersey.
I see. That is fascinating. That's really interesting. So tell us now about the evolution of the American side of the book, because obviously the European side was already in place when
right,
you got it.
Right.
So now you're going to add our chapter of history to the Jersey Project.
Yeah, and I fumbled around with it for a while, and Jerry just said, well, you just can't go, you know, he said, here's an opportunity to tell the story of the 70s, this era that you know intimately, that, you know, I'm kind of considered somewhat of a historian for that era. I don't profess to know. I mean, I've learned a lot from other historians about the previous history of the sport in America, but the 70s was an era that I know intimately, and I know that in any major movement, there's a lot of energy that goes into it before it becomes a breakthrough moment, and we were part of that era. You know, the 70s produced LeMond Younger and led to the early 80s, and led to 7-Eleven, and then the 80s just became really fast and a lot of sponsorship, which led, you know, right into the 90s, which then became Motorola and moved on to a whole other segment. But way back in the 70s, say from 68 to 78, in that era, the sport was a subculture, and I was intimately involved with it, and I said, that's the era I'm going to focus on. I'm going to get jerseys starting in the 70s right up to the end of the Le Mans era, which seems to be a good segue, and I'm going to focus on that and try to get jerseys from that era only, and finally tell the story in the process of that era through the jerseys.
That is so cool. How many jerseys did you accumulate for that era, and have you given that era a name?
You know, it's broken up into that 50 pages of chapters and segmented. But I had to go back, and first of all, I had to approach guys, you know, from 35 and 40 years ago.
Sure.
And thanks to the internet and Facebook, I knew where a lot of people were, and I had to come up with a canned statement, and I wanted to acknowledge the water carriers, the guys that never got a phone call, that raced their butts off from the 70s into the 80s on circuits up and down the East Coast, won a lot of races, never got asked to be on a U.S. team, have now moved on, still race a little bit in Masters, and in some cases don't race at all. But I wanted to find those guys, and in honor of the Dutch section, which covered everybody, the small pro who only raced for 3 years is in there. And so I said the 70s would be it, and I want to call on guys who were workhorses, not just the rock stars. And I said, well, how do I do that? Well, you find them, you send them an email, and you acknowledge them, and you tell them that you're putting this book together, and you would love to have them involved. Do they have any old jerseys? And if they have some, could they dig them out and then photograph them? I don't want people sending me their precious jerseys.
Of course.
And shipping them back.
Sure.
So we had to figure on that process. So I had to send basic photo instructions. And I ended up approaching about 180 people. And out of that 180, a lot of them were busy. A lot of them were thrilled to get the invite to be involved. I mean, some guys that are well-known riders that I worked with that were thrilled and very honored that I would contact them. But whether they actually came through and sent me jerseys was another story. Life goes on. People are busy. A variety of reasons, they didn't all send me a jersey. So out of that 180 people, maybe I got 46 people that I acknowledge in the back of the book that took the time to send me photographs of their jerseys. And a lot of cases, they sent 15 or 20 photographs, and they gave me background on who else could have worn that jersey so I could put other names besides theirs underneath the jerseys.
Wow.
So that became the trials and tribulations, and I started that process in October and, finally realized, okay, I've got enough for 50 pages here.
And so the American portion of the Jersey Project is 50 pages long.
It is, yeah. And so it's broken up into several different segments.
The book that you're going to be taking up to Battenkill, and we'll talk about your exciting kind of thing that's happening up there at the book signing. I want to know about the book itself, though. What are you taking up there? What is the format of that book? How many pages is that book?
Okay, the Jersey Project is 200 pages, hard copy.
Okay.
It's 150 pages of European jerseys, beautiful full page.
Got it.
Some pages have 15 jerseys on them.
Uh-huh.
With a separate introduction with the author of that part and a picture of Hank and his collection. Hank Toons is the original collector of all these European jerseys, and he has possibly, I would say arguably, the biggest jersey collection in the world, over 3,500 jerseys.
Wow.
And these European pros, Hank was like a Graham Watson. He was the photographer for Wheeler Review for 16 years and followed the tour on the back of a motorcycle.
Got it.
And all the pros knew him, and they all felt like, wow, you know, I've got this jersey. I'm going to take it off. I'm going to give it to Hank. I know it's in a safe place because I trade them, lose them, sign them. Like most American guys that don't have any jerseys left, they gave them to juniors. They have maybe one. But Hank became the official. It's safe if I give it to Hank, and he has been the keeper of the European history for all these years. So the second 150 pages with an introduction leads into the European segment.
The jerseys of the day when you were racing back in the 70s were basically wool, embroidered, and what they called flocked jerseys.
Yeah, that's how we started with wool, and there wasn't a lot of I talk about the effect of the jersey when you put it on, the wool. Then I talk about the club jerseys and how sponsorship wasn't allowed at a certain point. Sponsorship only was allowed in 1972.
Okay.
And then you can see mostly bike shops and bike parts on the names of jerseys. And then regional clubs started to grow and, more and more bike clubs, and then all of a sudden you started to see, you know, different companies that weren't industry-related on the jerseys, and then the jerseys started to transcend from wool into a more of acrylic.
Well, and now, of course, you have these splashy, super multicolor sublimated jerseys with a gazillion,
right,
names and things on them. Do you think something's been lost from that sort of, Multenny orange and, you know, black jersey of the day to compare it to some of the, like, the sky jersey and the, you know, some of the things from today, the BMCs?
I mean, it was a different era, and some of the guys are hearkening back to that. Some of the designs are starting to get clearer and simpler with their graphics. And the old era is becoming very popular now. I mean, the industry, Ralpha is one example.
That's true.
Make a classic, and guys are looking and paying up to $150 for a wool jersey with embroidery on it now that are reproductions that are top quality. So the that era is starting to become popular again.
Before I let you go, and I know you have to go, tell us a little bit about what's going to happen tomorrow and who's going to be there.
Well, you know, I'm going up to the Tour of Battenkill, which I've never been to before, and it's a huge event on the East Coast, and anybody's book. It's the official opening of the season, as it were. And Greg LeMond is the guest up there, and Greg is somebody that I coached years ago, and I've stayed in contact with Greg over the years, and you know, I've been to his house for dinner. He's been to my house and coached my juniors for an entire day. I have a page and a half, 2 pages on Greg in the book, and he was at the bike show and signed books for me very graciously, and now he's going to be signing books with me at the Battenkill bookstore tomorrow morning for an hour or so, and I'm going to donate a certain amount of the proceeds to his foundation, and I'm with VeloNation.com, which is the website that I work for now, and they're a sponsor of the event. So between Dieter, the race director, and Greg being a guest, and me having the book and being a sponsor, it all came together, and it's going to be an exciting weekend.
So tell our listeners how they can get a copy of The Jersey Project.
Well, right now, if you go to thejerseyproject.com, that is the main website. It's not available on Amazon. It's not. It's not available through, you know, Velo Press and the normal big outlets. I'm a one-man show. And when you go to that site and you click on the second page, you'll see other bike shops that are carrying the book.
Okay.
And some of those shops have websites where you can buy it.
I guess I should be carrying the book, huh?
Yeah.
I guess you should.
Absolutely. A shop like yours, absolutely.
It is my kind of book. Well, I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're packing and ready to load it on up. And I'd like you to remind Greg LeMond he still owes me an interview.
Oh, I'll get his ear tomorrow, Diane. You can be sure of that.
That's not a problem. You have a great time up in Battenkill. And, Bill, thank you so much for being a guest on the show this evening.
Well, thank you for what you do with your show.
Thank you.
I look forward to staying in touch with you.
All righty. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bill Humphreys joined us from New Lyme.
Old Lyme.
Old Lyme, Connecticut.
Old Lyme, New Lyme. It's the stuff you put in tequila, you know.
He's already out the door on his way to Battenkill by the time I think this interview is over. So
I'd love to be a mouse in the room with all those celebs,
yeah,
huh?
It's
going to be nice. The book is beautiful. Really, really beautiful.
Yeah,
Very cool.
The history of cycling is interesting, and so many of us, you know, too young to remember it ourselves. So it's nice to look back at that and see, you know, where we started.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sort of going back in time.
All right. Let's jump out of here and take a short break.
Okay.
And when we come back, another great guest.
Yes, indeed. John Campo.
All right.
Who's in New York City, will be joining us.
Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Sunday, April 22nd, the Earth Day Coalition presents EarthFest 2012, Ohio's largest environmental education event and the longest-running Earth Day festival in the nation, at Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. This family-friendly event begins at 10 a.m. and runs till 5 p.m., featuring hundreds of exhibits, children's activities, and music. Zoo admission will be waived for registered participants in the Walk for the Earth and those who ride the free RTA shuttle from Cleveland Public Square. More information at earthdaycoalition.org.
I'm Greg Pretty.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to go straight away out to New York City.
And talk with John Campo. Campo Cat, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm really good. How's New York?
It's kind of crazy. It's a little like California weather out here this year.
Yeah, I know. Ohio's not
you
much
gotta
different.
You got to carry everything in, you know, everything in your kit has to come along with you everywhere you go.
Well, you know, I spend a fair amount of my week working on this show. And a few months ago, I came across something. Evidently, you know Steve Garrow.
Evidently.
Yeah, and he posted about you on Facebook.
Really?
And
what a wonderful guy. I love him.
And then that's how I learned about you. And I also learned that there are many, many layers to John Campo, figured we should talk.
It gets me in a lot of trouble.
I'm sure it does. And we'll get to cycling and your connection to it, but fill us in on a little bit on who you are, where you live, and what you do, and leave the cycling part sort of at the end.
Where I live in New York City.
Okay.
I grew up in Greenwich Village, a very poor Italian family. And, my parents moved to Brooklyn when I was about 3 years old, and I grew up in an Irish neighborhood where I was constantly beat up as a little Italian kid. And I left Brooklyn when I was about 16 years old when I graduated high school and started my career as a musician. But I started riding bikes in Brooklyn when I was about 12 years old, when my dad finally could afford to get me one. Everybody else kind of had their bikes, you know, but it took me a while to get mine and to learn how to ride. And then once I did, I came to find out that my father was a six-day racer. And
your father?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
No, well, you know, my father never really talked about stuff much, so.
Yeah, mine didn't either.
You know,
he's not still alive, is he?
No, he's passed long
ago. Yeah, that's too bad. We'd love to hear about his six-day stuff, huh?
Well, I traced it back because I'm in touch with riders in the neighborhood here. And, you know, they all talk about six-day, and they all talk about all the great riders. You know, I can't think of most of them.
Well, like Walthour.
Huh?
Like Walthour.
Like Walthour, but you know the Italian ones.
Oh, of course.
You know, the Italian ones that they were kind of crazy about. So I can't think of some of the names, but you know I went to a USI Christmas meeting because I was trying to gain funds for my junior programs, and I was just blown away. USI was the the bike club from the village and you know the Little Italy neighborhoods. And these guys had all the history on all the riders. But I kind of made the connection there. It was just like, boom, the light went off in my head. And I met a whole bunch of the riders. And some of the older riders are still doing it up there in Westchester. They're located in Westchester. And they run what's called a Gimbel's ride. It starts at a place that used to be Gimbel's in the Cross County Shopping Center. And all the great riders from our area, Hincapie and everybody, you know, that was a big ride. They call it a ride, but it actually is a race.
Sure.
And it takes me 40 miles to get there, and then it's a 40-mile race, and then it's 40 miles coming home. So it's a full day's workout, and it's the only point-to-point thing we have here. Everything else takes place in parks.
So let's talk a little bit about your music. Can we do that?
Absolutely.
All right. So you actually build guitars.
I'm not a guitar builder. I don't want to get all the luthiers crazy because they all get crazy on me.
Okay.
They think I'm going to like steal their jobs away from them. But you know, I've been a finished woodworker in my family, so it's something I didn't have to learn.
Okay.
It was in my blood. You know, I never was an apprentice. I just started as a carpenter at 10 years old with my father. And there is, my father's family made violins in Italy. So, you know, it's there. But, you know, it's like being a bike mechanic and being a bike racer.
Right.
You know, you want to be a bike racer. I don't want to touch bikes. If I have to change my tire, that's fine, but that's about it. I give it to a mechanic.
Right.
And the same thing with my guitar. You know, I know what I want, and I know the mechanics of how guitars are built, and I know what's bad about them, and I know what's good about them. So I just wanted to build a couple of guitars for myself, and, you know, I was able to do that. So
you've actually had some hit songs.
Yes. My dad and I used to play weddings when I was about from the time I was 10 to 13, and then when I went to high school, I was like a celebrity in high school, and you know, I was a five-string banjo player, and every Kingston Trio group needed the banjo player.
That's true.
So I was thrown around from pillar to post, and I got to see a lot of different ethnic groups besides the one I grew up in, and that was really great. And then when I left high school, I was playing in Your Father's Mustache, which was a Dixieland band. And that's where I met all the jazz musicians there. You know, I go with Howard Johnson to Princeton and do, you know, Sorority House or whatever. And until I learned the songs. The first couple of gigs, I only knew about 10 songs. And the rest of the time, I was just faking it, playing a lot of C major or something.
Greg's smiling over here.
And the club just got... You know, I was in the 60s, and I was, you know, I was writing folk songs and stuff, and the beer and peanuts crowd, they were throwing beer and peanuts at us all night. And it just got really tiresome.
Sounds like it.
So I started going to the cafes and playing my blues and my songs and stuff like that with the rest of the folk singers and the blues players. And sure enough, I got a record contract. You know.
So the one song you sent me, The Worm...
The Worm is something I wrote recently, which I've been playing with my rhythm guitar player.
So we're going to play a little bit of it.
All righty.
John Campo playing his song, The Worm.
The Worm.
The Worm. So how'd you come up with that name? I love the song. It's awesome.
Well, it's kind of X-rated.
Oh. All righty then. All righty then. Well, should we just move along?
It's in the blues vein of, Stanley Turrentine type stuff, which I really like to play mostly. But, you know, when I get on gigs, people really want to hear standards. You know?
Yeah, you know, like... Play Melancholy Baby.
Yeah, really. Play Melancholy Baby. Play this. Every once in a while, a guy come up to me and say, "You're not playing enough Wayne Shorter." I'm saying, "No, I don't know if he's trying to impress me that he knew that song was Wayne Shore or what. And it turned out the guy was like the head of NYU Jazz Department, and he just went crazy over my stuff. I played, what did I play? I played some surfing music, and I worked it into Softly as the Morning Sunrise, and he went like totally nuts over it. I was like, wow.
You never know what people are going to like there, Campo.
I know, and most of the songs I get are a request, I tell you.
Interesting.
People give me a request, and I play it really badly, and I embarrass myself, and then I go home. I rise in a rage for it, and it just sticks.
So let's play one more of your songs.
Okay.
And this one is?
That's Parisina you're going to play?
Paris, I think so.
Yeah, Parisina is a McCoy Tyner tune that's really close to my heart. I learned it on stage in Tucson one Christmas. I had to go out there for a Christmas gig with David Bromberg and his brother Brian and a saxophone player, Marvin Blackman, that passed. But he was an excellent, excellent guy. And he just started playing it, and away I went, and I just fell in love with the tune. And it took me like 20 years to find out what it really sounded like, because I had never heard McCoy ever play it.
So let's listen to a little bit of it right now. That was awesome. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. So, again, we're talking with John Campo. He's in New York City. And maybe we'll actually talk a little bit about bicycling. What do you think?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So one of the things that you seem to have in your possession are a ton of photographs about cycling. What are those?
I'm a writer, so
That's true.
I'm just researching the internet and putting together photographs, because people don't like to talk and they don't like to read. I can't get anybody to read my books. I can't get anybody to carry on a decent conversation. So what I do is I'll post these photographs in order to pry things out of people, to different subjects on family and junior programs and what's happening to our cities and what's happening to cycling in general. I got hit by a car today.
Are you kidding me?
I mean, who cares?
Does anybody care?
I don't think anybody cares.
Did you really get hit by
a car? If I call 911, they're going to laugh at me. I just called the car service because I got the guy's number from the side of the car, and he laughed at me. So, you know, I'm getting tired of getting hit by cars.
So, wait a minute. You're in New York City where you have the bicycle commissioner.
Yeah, I was in the bike lane, too, 3 blocks away from my house.
And you were on your bike.
You know, I saw she's on Facebook, and she posted this thing. Oh, but her cycling deaths are down. You know, I'm going to get crap for this. I've been in a talk.
No, you know what? It's okay. On this show, you're allowed to talk about that. This is about bicycling.
You know, I told her, I said,
about the traffic.
You're saying bicycle deaths are down. Those are the ones that were reported. You mean?
Aha. Uh-huh. Interesting.
You know, I know a lot of firemen, and firemen are told not to report certain things that happen that they see. Because they're trying to keep the numbers of crime down.
Well, and New York is such a huge city. Jeez. So, were you hurt? Were you hurt today?
More of my ego than anything else.
Yeah, okay.
But still, I mean, you know
what everybody,
by the car.
You know what everybody else is going to want to know? How's your bike?
Yeah, right? Well, it's just my street bike. You know, hey.
Just not a big deal. Well, that's really weird.
You can't have a connection with your street bike, you know, because it might... When you walk out of a building, you might be gone.
I see. So you should just have a generic bike and
That's
just say, it's just a bike.
That's it.
So tell us a little bit about the Velodrome, the Casino Velodrome.
Casino Velodrome, I started going there in 84 when Al Tofield ran the place. And I was in Century Road Club at the time because, actually, I went to buy a pair of shoes. And when I was in there buying my shoes, my track bike was stolen because I was enrolled in T-Town's program, and I was about to go out there, and I couldn't go out there without shoes, you know, so I was really dejected, but they sold me another track bike, which I was paying off on time, and in the meanwhile, my coach told me, join Century, you know, I really didn't want a road ride, because I had done it when I was a kid, road racing, and, you know, I just fell in love with track racing because of what my dad told me, and because of watching the 84 Olympics.
Yes, I actually have a poster from the L.A. Olympics track.
You know, I know all those guys now really well, and it's just so cool. It was like a big thing for me, and most of them would tell me, "Yeah, it's nothing to it. Forget about it."
So you actually made this track come alive again.
Yeah,
you're the track director.
Yeah, I was the poster child for the track. I was. A friend of mine who's in France now, running a velodrome in France, he got me involved in it. He was promoting races for John Huestis. And he said, John, come on, we can put this together. Because we were trying to find a place for a track in New York City. And we went through the Harlem Velodrome and this velodrome. And I pulled a lot of stops out and tried to get a lot of favors from people to get those projects going. And they went so far and died. And I was left with egg on my face. So I said, well, the Casino Velodrome's here. Al's gone. He's dead. Nobody else wants to run the place. The Casino Cycle Club was pretty much in the hole. So it was basically three or four of us at the Casino Cycle Club running the place and running the team. So I called the president, and I said, what's happening with the Velodrome? He said, well, we can't do anything until we get a container. I said, I'll get a container. So a container was going to cost, I don't know, $5,000 delivered. And
this is a dumpster container, something
you No, a container, like a trailer container.
Oh.
You know, like you see Maersk Trucking and
Sealand. I got it.
There's a million of them in Newark just laying there because we import things we never export.
Right.
So I know the Maersk Shipping Container Company, and they donated me because they're Danes and they understand junior programs. They donated a container for me, and that was it. That was all I needed because for years and years, nobody, you know, we had to bring everything to the track every night.
Right.
And you can't run a program like that because I knew from San Diego, I have a house in San Diego, and that's where I first started track racing. And I knew what they did there to put their track in order. Well, the first thing they did was get a container.
Okay.
And they got a fence, and, you know, they had a director, and they had a phone number and stuff like that. That's what you needed. So I got the container, and then I ran the program for a few years on a shoestring. I had old numbers from races that I had saved, and I would use those numbers to give to people. And They were all like grumbling, like, what's this? It's a whole number had blood stains on it.
Oh, jeez. You're lucky the health department didn't shut you down.
I'd have to go to Canal Street and buy pins.
Right.
And it was just funny, you know, and I was the picture of me in Cycling Magazine, I'm fixing the wheel because my spokes would keep breaking and, you know, I have loaner bikes for people and stuff, and I'd try to drag messengers off the streets across the track, anything I could, you know, to get to keep the place going. And then I got a contractor to fix the track, and I finally got the city to sign off on it. And I told them, okay, Saturday I'm repaving the track. But actually what happened was I asked the cycling community, I needed $55,000 to do this, and I asked the cycling community for the money, and nobody gave me money. So the last day of the season, I was riding around, I was just about to leave the track forever, say goodbye to it, and John Kamen from Radical Media, well, his son was a junior at the track, he said, John, what do you need? And I said, John, please don't do this to me, I'm walking away. You know, and he said, no, I'll get you the money.
Wow.
And I was like, oh.
The 11th hour save, dude.
I know. It was like, oh, John, man, he really put me in something, you know. Cause, okay, so John gives me the 55, I call the city. I show up on Saturday, the commissioner's there, and he says, how do you think you could do this for $55,000? I said, well, what do you want me to do? Tell the guy, oh, look, I'll give you $500,000?
Right.
You know, he said he could do it for $55,000.
Right.
And I saw his work. He paved 9th Avenue in Manhattan. He's a city contractor.
Okay.
So they said, well, let him put in a bid. We're going to pave the track. I said, I've been trying to get you to pave this track for 20 years, and now the day that I come here to pave the track, you tell me you found the money. Thank you very much.
Wow.
And I felt like, I felt terrible, this poor man. You know, here he was, you know.
So wait, you didn't take the $55,000 from the other guy?
No, we took the $55,000. The city took it, actually.
And the track did get paved?
The track got paved. They've spent $500,000 to get it paved.
Is this a bank track or a flat track?
It's an old-fashioned bank track, but it's a quarter mile like they had in, you know, back in the day. In the
sure.
50s. You know, it's the way Detroit was and, you know, many of the old tracks from that era. You know, it's kind of like the in-between era from when the six-day thing was happening. See, when the six-day thing was happening, they had enough money to just build the track whenever they came to town.
Right.
You know, even in Madison Square Garden, they just built that track.
Right.
At night.
Right.
So those days are gone, the labor costs and the material costs. So what they did was in the 60s, they just made these big, big old quarter-mile ovals out of asphalt. But in the Northeast, you got the cold and the freezing and the cracking and the buffing and the this and the that. And most of the places they put these tracks are, you know, somewhere where it's a, you know, garbage dump or something like that. So, you know, anytime you pave it, it's only going to last 5 years the most. And this last thing lasted 5 years. And now we need it to be redone again.
Wow.
But the big thing was we got a fence. And I designed the fence with the architect from the city. And it's just wonderful, and it keeps all the Visigoth away from
destroying it even worse.
It's funny because the commissioner got on the bike at the old grand opening. And he says, "John, these bikes have no brakes."
And you went, "Really?
Oh wow, holy! What was I thinking?
What was I thinking?
Here,
it's a track bike.
And we have this little junior program with half the school kids, and the school kids are running all around the track on the track bikes.
Right."
Like, you know, nobody's business. They have no fear.
No, they don't. That's absolutely true. We're getting ready to open our first track since the six-day era outdoors.
Yeah, that's great.
In June.
That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So, man, I wish we had, like, all night to talk.
I have so many subjects, you know.
I know. So the last thing I'm going to ask you about is what you think about the way cycling is today. The world is,
you know, Aubrey said a lot of great things, you know, about the African thing, and that's one thing. Every time I get asked some stupid article for the Times about this and that, you know, I said, why aren't you asking the hard questions? Why isn't there a black man in the Tour of France? They're not good enough.
Isn't that interesting? Well, you know, I'm actually going to be talking with Jacques Boyer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's next week, and he is coaching Team Rwanda.
I know. I love it. I saw that.
So maybe we'll see this sooner or later.
There was, I think, one or two in the Irish team, too, a couple of years ago.
Well, it's funny you say that. I had a young man working for me years ago who was African-American, and he was a great rider. And we have a team called Class A Breakaway. Great riders, you know, a black team here in Northeast Ohio. And then there's a team in Columbus called Major Taylor.
Oh, yeah. I know them very well.
Yeah, sure. So, but the question, I think the question is an interesting one. It's sort of...
Vincent Oliver is a close friend of mine, and he was definitely world caliber. And why he never got looked at? Was just a disaster, a total disaster.
Interesting.
You know, and he will not talk about it. If I say something, he'll just say, I say, well, you, did they ever say anything to you? And he said, no.
Well.
You know, and he's not really a guy that would push himself either, you know, but.
You mean on somebody? Yeah, no, he wouldn't be pushy about it, right.
Because he has his own self-respect, you know, and he knows where it's going to go anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
It's unbelievable to me how short-sighted some of these organizations have been over the years. And, you know, it looks like elitist cycling, and that is sort of what comes up, elitist cycling. I'm hoping to see some changes with some of the newer teams. I hope so.
Yeah, me too. You know, I think Jonathan and his team, Garmin.
Yeah.
He is the real deal.
Good.
Jonathan, I love him so much. He's the only one that I can, if I need something, I say, Jonathan, I have a junior rider that has cancer. You know, he's one of my best riders. And he, if you could just call him, he said, John, what does he need? Does he want a signed jersey? We'll send him a signed jersey. Boom. 2 weeks later, the signed jersey comes to the kid's house. And he goes, who did this?
Yeah, right. Nobody. It just dropped out of the sky. That's awesome. Well, you know, this has been delightful, as I knew it would be. And so people got to hear some of your music.
That's
and there
wonderful.
Are there are books.
Mm-hmm.
You have 5 books, which we didn't even get to talk about. But we'll do a...
There's cycling in it, too. So they're not just all pulp.
That's right. There is. Well, you know, we'll plug a couple of the books on the Facebook site and on the WJCU site.
Wow, this has been great. And I'm going to run through all your shows right now because... You have a wonderful, wonderful show.
Thank you. Well, we have fun doing it, and I really had fun talking with you. So have a wonderful night.
Thank you so much. If you're in New York, give me a buzz, and we'll go for a ride.
And I definitely will do that. Thanks a lot, John.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
John Campo joined us from New York City, where he does anything and everything, apparently.
He does. These photographs are unbelievably
and
wonderful.
He's a hell of a guitar player, too.
Yes, he is. And I had no idea that that's what he was doing with this photography. That, you know, because these images are random and some of them are beautiful sunsets, beautiful sunrises. And then this bicycle will show up, you know, like the head tube of a bicycle I've never seen before in pink. That was up this week.
The world is full of all kinds of unassuming people doing extraordinary things,
yes,
really,
it is.
When you think about it.
Truly.
And John falls into that category, you know. Not real well-known, at least, you know, not in mainstream circles.
Right.
But doing incredible things nonetheless.
Yep. And I read a few excerpts from one of his books, and his writing style is excellent.
Hmm.
It's fun. It's fast. It's easy read. And you can see he really gets into it.
Cool.
So are we getting into it?
We're getting out of it.
We're getting out of it. Okay,
we're getting out of here before they kick us out.
Yeah, that's true.
And, but rest assured, we'll be back at you in another week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
We will indeed. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.